Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books and Religion. I'm your co-host, Hilary Kale. At the dawn of the radio age in the 1920s, Frederick Duvernay, Anglican bishop and self-declared scientist, announced a psychic channel by which minds could telepathically communicate across distance. Pamela Clausen retells Duvernay's imaginative experiment in her newest book, The Story of Radio Mind, A Missionary's Journey on Indigenous Land. Following Duvernay's journey westward across Canada, Clausen examines how contests over the mediation of stories via photography, maps, printing presses, and radio reveal the spiritual work of colonial settlement. Pamela Clausen is professor in the Department for the Study of Religion at the University of Toronto, and she's here to tell us more about Radio Mind. Hello and welcome to NBIR.
Thank you, Hilary.
Now, you might not realize it, but this is a momentous interview. It's an anniversary of sorts, because this is exactly 4 years ago in 2014 that we spoke about your previous book, Spirits of Protestantism, which was my first NBIR podcast. So this is actually incredibly important. Everyone should be taking note who's listening to this podcast. Momentous. And in some ways, this story that you're telling now is an extension of that earlier project, because Duvernay came up in Spirits of Protestantism too. So tell us a little bit about him and what made you decide to focus on him at greater length.
Sure. So having encountered him in the Spirits of Protestantism research, I knew that there had to be more of a story behind how this Anglican clergyman came to think about this the idea of telepathy in the way that he did, and then came to dub it Radio Mind and write about it so enthusiastically and so publicly. So I dug around in some archives here and there, and I was really lucky that an archivist at the Anglican Church Archives in Toronto gave me a copy of a diary he had written when he went to the Rainy River in 1898, which is a Ojibwe territory, Treaty 3 territory. And the diary really was a very different voice of Duvernay from other sources that I'd read. In it, he is actually quite open about the challenges of being a missionary on Ojibwe land when many of the Ojibwe men and women that he met wanted to have nothing to do with him and were quite opposed to missionaries coming to their territory and trying to teach their children and build their churches. And he reflects a lot on what it's like to be a colonial Christian missionary settler in the late 19th century. So I knew that he was someone who had thought about some of the issues that we might now think of in terms of settler colonialism. He, of course, didn't use those words, but he clearly understood. Well, he did use the word settler and he did use the word colonial, but he didn't put the two together. So he clearly was aware of Indigenous resistance to Christianity, as well as Indigenous people whom he met who were actually interested in what he had to say, and who actually, in some cases, did become missionaries themselves. So I ended up wanting to go to where he had been, a bishop and then an archbishop in Prince Rupert, in what people now call, some people now call British Columbia, right in the very northwest corner. So like the next stop is Alaska, basically. And after a long time of trying to let the church archivist there know that I really wanted to come and see the materials they had in the archive, they finally, I finally managed to find a time that would suit their schedule, and showed up and was told that there was just one tiny little file about Duvernay. But luckily, I came with two research assistants, and we were there for almost a week. And as we got to know the archivist a little bit better, we got to see more and more of the files that he would pick out from the archives as he learned of what we were interested in. And by the end of our trip, we had realized that here was an Anglican bishop living in the middle of a very active Indigenous land movement, which he knew a lot about and knew well, that the Nisga, the Haida, the Tsimshian of that area had never ceded their land in a treaty, in any, or even signed any treaties with the crown. And he was a really strong opponent of residential schools. So putting all those things together, I realized there was definitely a bigger story I wanted to tell. And that's what the book became.
I want to get back to some of those topics in a moment. But as you know, there's a few different ways that one could write a biography. So, I mean, one way would be just to trace Duvernay's personal and family history. But you chose to organize the book differently. Did it seem immediately apparent to you how to tell his story? At what point did you come up with the structure for the book?
Well, I was long interested in questions of mediation. And of course, you know, when a guy's invented a theory that he calls a radio mind, thinking about media and storytelling through media really comes fairly easily. And then gradually I realized there were a whole range of different kinds of media that shaped the way he engaged with other settlers, other missionaries, and Indigenous peoples, including Indigenous Christians. And so that's slowly where the structure of thinking about photography, of thinking about maps in the relationship between missionaries and Indigenous peoples, and thinking about printing presses, which was one of my most exciting discoveries for me, is thinking about the way the printing press worked in relationships between missionaries and the Nisga especially. And then radio, of course, as the last chapter. But actually, it was when I sort of presented this mediation framework to my editor that he took a look at it. His name's Alan Thomas. And he said, you know, you could really just tell this as a story. And that really just freed me right up. And I decided I wanted to really think about it as a story, but also think about how the ways we tell stories, the media we use to tell stories, really does have an important sort of ethical dimension to it, and a very significant cultural and spiritual dimension to it as well. And that's part of what the clash and the forms of understanding that passed between missionaries in early 20th century and Indigenous peoples. Part of what shaped those interactions was the ways they told stories to each other, sometimes understanding each other, sometimes not, sometimes resisting each other, and especially on the part of Indigenous people, sometimes borrowing forms of Christian and colonial mediation to really argue against Christian and Canadian claims to their land, to their souls, to their children, in the case of residential schools as well.
That's so interesting that the central concept for the book in terms of storytelling came up at a later stage, because it's also so fundamental to the way that history is told, right? That certain mm-hmm. histories seem to be, you know, more authoritative, whereas other histories and primarily oral narratives, of course, in the context of Indigenous people in Canada, have been given much less weight as history. And so that central theme that runs throughout the book works on a whole bunch of different levels at once. So you mentioned the Rainy River expedition. And for our readers who haven't yet picked up the book, Duvernay himself came from Quebec. He ended up in Toronto. And the first time, before he ends up in British Columbia, or what is today British Columbia, the first time that he really encounters Indigenous people is when he goes to Rainy River. And he's in his 30s at the time, as you mentioned in the book. And one of the things about the Rainy River trip that so struck me is that he's taking photographs the whole time. So this is the media that you're focused on in that chapter. And yet the photos are not actually available to us today. So for you, how did those photos help express what Duvernay was doing and thinking, what the Ojibwe people he encountered were doing and thinking?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. I will make one tiny correction. In looking at his life, I realized, well, actually, I didn't make this realization. One of my research assistants, who just happens to be my daughter, discovered that when he was a teenager, he was tutored by an Inuit man who was in the Eastern Townships, was himself training to become, on the way to becoming an Anglican priest, and was Duvernay's tutor, and ended up becoming Duvernay's brother-in-law. But that's a whole other story you can read.
You're right. And in fact, the way that my question was worded originally was the first time that he encountered Indigenous people on their own land. So
yes.
I should have actually read the question out instead of paraphrasing.
Yeah. I mean, that's partly why the biographical became so interesting to me, because there were these relatively unusual twists in this man's life that I thought really, and maybe they're not as unusual as I might think, but you don't really read about these kinds of twists so much in the lives of an Anglican clergyman. Mm-hmm. So the question of the photographs, and it was precisely because I didn't actually have any photographs that I came to think so intentionally about what it meant that this missionary, he was at that point, he was kind of a missionary journalist. He was writing for the Anglican Canadian Church newspaper, the Gleaner, they called it. And he wrote in his diary about trying to take photographs of many different people along the Rainy River. So this is a part, the Rainy River has long been a very important thoroughfare for the Anishinaabe, for other Indigenous peoples. It's also now what is considered to be the border between Canada and the United States. So it's a really got a very rich history, that part of the world. And when he's there in 1898, it's post Treaty 3. There are 7 reserves along the river. And as he goes to different reserves, he meets some Ojibwe people who are very interested in what he has to say, and others who are clearly not at all interested. He's guided along the way by a Cree Anglican missionary named Jeremiah Johnston, and he and Jeremiah travel through these different reserves. At one point, they're traveling by canoe, and he makes sure to bring his big, bulky camera with him. So he really wanted to have his dry plate camera with him at all points, because he saw himself as a sort of photographer of sorts. And so at some points, people clearly, and he writes about this, clearly say, no, you can't take my picture. So at one point, he's at one of the reserves where there's less interest in Christian missionaries coming to visit, and he meets with a chief who he calls Chief Great Hawk, who has on many occasions asked missionaries to leave and to stop trying to proselytize to his people. And he tries to convince Great Hawk to stand for a picture, but with this dry plate camera, it takes quite a long time to actually get the people you're trying to photograph to stay still long enough so you can actually take their picture, just technologically speaking. And as he writes in the diary, you know, Great Hawk stood there briefly, and then he moved, and the picture was ruined. In another occasion, Jeremiah Johnston's wife, Mary Johnston, really wants Frederick Duvernay to take a picture of her little boy, because she's worried that he's sickly and ill, and she's lost several of her children to various diseases already at that point. She did have 4 children on the Rainy River when he came to visit. And so he tries to take a picture of little Sammy sitting by the riverbank, and then notes that he probably ruined the film because he'd clicked on the shutter too many times and all the pictures were probably ruined. But never mind. It pleased the mother anyways, because all she wanted was a picture of her child. And of course, she wasn't going to get to look at it right away because he would have had to take it back and develop it. And so there's a lot of interesting moments where he, on the one hand, really focuses on the importance of documenting people with the camera. On the other hand, notes Ojibwe people who are saying, no, you cannot take my picture. There's a particularly interesting example of that with a woman elder that I won't get into here, but is in the book. But then on the other hand, when it doesn't work, he just sort of laughs it off. So it was really exciting when we have none of those pictures, because either he ruined them or they were never saved. I think likely they never worked out in the first place. But the Minnesota Historical Archives, Minnesota Historical Society has these amazing archives. And while I was doing research for the chapter, I came across photos they have of Jeremiah Johnston, of Mary Johnston, of her son Sammy, and her daughters Beatrice and Isabel. And then later members of their family. And so it was really exciting when I got to actually see them in photographs taken by a completely different photographer, but very close to that same time. And it made me realize that it was probably a good thing that I really thought through the diary without the photographs in hand, because it really allowed me to think about what scholars call the photographic encounter, what happens between two people when one person's trying to take a picture of another person, which I think is a real encounter still today that we can think about and learn from. So yeah, having the photos and not having the photos were both really important parts for me to think through what photography meant in that encounter.
As the title suggests, you're especially interested in the part of Duvernay's life that we already mentioned. So when he went to the West Coast as bishop in the Anglican Church, and he was in this place that the Anglican Church called the Diocese of Caledonia. Take us back to that corner up near Alaska that you were talking about. What was that place like when he arrived in 1904? Was it similar to the Rainy River? Was it different? What was it like for him to be on Indigenous land again, but 6 years later?
In some ways, it's very similar in that a lot of the cities or towns that people might now know of in northwestern British Columbia were not there. So there was no Prince Rupert in 1904 when he arrived. In another way, it's really fundamentally different in the context of, importantly different in that there were no treaties in most of British Columbia. When he was at the Rainy River, Treaty 3 had been signed between Ojibwe leaders and the Crown. Now, what the Crown thought Treaty 3 meant and what the Ojibwe leaders thought Treaty 3 meant was not at all the same thing, even in 1898, but there was no treaty at all in British Columbia. And that really made for a significantly different orientation to how the Nisga, how the Tsimshian, how the Haida understood their lands that had been mapped, as you say, by the Anglican Church as the Diocese of Caledonia, which is really just what I call a complete spiritual invention, right, through mapping and naming. It was also different in that, or I guess maybe similar, in that there were you could only access this area by water. There were no roads, there were no rail lines, but it had been, he arrives right at the time when colonial surveyors are surveying the land and come to decide that there's a harbor at what is now called Prince Rupert. There's a harbor that's deep enough that it would be the perfect place to be the end point of a northern rail line. So the Rainy River territory was also deeply negatively shaped by the expansion of the Canadian Pacific Railway coast to coast in the late 19th century. And then the early 20th century, the area that he goes to in the northwest and Tsimshian Land does become the endpoint of a new rail line, the Grand Trunk Pacific Railway. Once the railway arrives in 1913, 1914, the land entirely changes and the settlers come streaming in and Duvernay's job changes. So when he gets there, he's sort of the head largely of a number of churches organized by or planted by missionaries in the late 19th century. Missionaries who were largely British men, and there are churches that are focused on indigenous communities. And by the time of his death, they had moved, the Anglican Church in that part of the country has moved largely from what it called Indian work, their term, to what they came to call white work. So really very racialized categories for what they understood their missionary labor to be.
One other medium, and you mentioned how exciting it was to think about this, that was really important in this new location was the printing press, or the iron pulpit, as one of Duvernay's colleagues, James McCullough, put it. So for listeners who know a little bit less about the importance of publishing in the context of Protestant missions, can you give us a sense of why these presses were viewed as so important, both to folks like Duvernay and James McCullough, but also to other people who are using these presses for their own publications and tracts? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's a really fascinating history of the printing press in missionary labor. Missionaries, as we were saying earlier, love to tell stories. Stories are utterly crucial to them being able to do their work. Still are today, I would say. But if you think about the media they used to do their work in the early 20th century, it was largely print. It was newspapers. It was journals. It was the, you know, Canadian Church Missionary Gleaner, the newspaper that Frederick Duvernay worked for. And then gradually also photography really becomes an important part of this as well. And so when he gets to Northwestern British Columbia, one of the most well-known missionaries that he had within his diocese was a guy named James McCullough, who had long worked among the Nisga in the Nass River, along the Nass River, which is really as pretty much as far north on the northwest coast that you can get and still be in what is now called Canada by some. And so James McCullough was he truly loved to tell stories more often about himself than about other people, but he was a very, very active writer. And he brought not one, but two printing presses to the Nass River, to the Nisga, in the late 19th century. And as I said earlier, you could only get there by steamer boat or by canoe, other kinds of water traffic. So we had to bring these very, very heavy printing presses up the river by boat. So it was, would have been quite an effort. What's so interesting about these two printing presses, there's two because one burns in a fire, which is quite a story unto itself that I tell in the book. But he brings the printing presses because he wants to print translations into the Nisga language of biblical tracts. He wants to write primers for learning Nisga English translation for learning language. So it actually becomes an important tool later on in language revitalization for the Nisga, some of the things he prints. But as with many technologies, you know, he's an older man. He doesn't actually know how to make the printing press work. He just knew he wanted one. And so the people who really help him figure out how it works are the young Nisga men. And they are basically printers they're not even printer's apprentices, because McCullough didn't even really know how to make the machine work himself. So together they figure it out, and these Niska printers become utterly central to his work in the mission and to having anything get printed at all on this press. And so it was really fascinating when I realized through some of the archival work I did, both in the Prince Rupert Church and also in the British Columbia Archives down in Victoria, that these Niska printers, in addition to helping McCullough with his, you know, biblical translations or primers, that sort of thing, were also printing protest tracts against what they called white settlement in the Nass River Valley. And so you can see this form of mediation is speaking with many different voices about what it means to be on Indigenous land, depending on whether you're a Niska printer or you're the missionary. Interestingly about McCullough as well is that he does also, together with these Niska printers, produce a journal, many different journals, but one of them was called Hagaga, and there are a number of interviews that he conducts with Niska chiefs, Niska leaders, about what was called the Indian land movement, Indian land question at the time.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So those sources are really important for thinking about questions of Niska sovereignty even today.
A not unrelated question has to do with Duvernay's feelings specifically about residential schools. And that issue, residential schools, will be well known to many of our listeners, especially if they're in Canada. What was his view of the schools? How did this connect to broader conversations that were happening in the Diocese of Caledonia?
Mm-hmm. So the residential schools in the context of this part of Canada, British Columbia, Niska Territory, Tsimshian Territory, many different names you can call this land. Residential schools were basically a church-state alliance in which churches ran these schools paid for by the government, in which they together tried to assimilate Indigenous children to become English-speaking Christian Canadians and to sever them from their language, their spiritual traditions, their land, their parents, their grandparents, their families, and as many people will know, had devastating consequences for generations of Indigenous people and continue to have devastating consequences. So interestingly, and I'm pretty sure I would have still found Radio Mind interesting, but I would not have found Frederick Duvernay quite as interesting if I also hadn't come to read his letters and realized that he articulated really from within a few years of arriving in what's now called Prince Rupert, a really strong critique of residential schools. He calls them, the evils of the residential school. He names them quite clearly, that basically that Indigenous children are taken to these schools and many of them don't return because they die there because of the diseases that are spread in these schools and that they're not cared for properly. He also says why would the church and government take these children away from their parents when their parents care for them so well and their parents want them to go to school close to them? And he regularly shares this perspective with government officials in Ottawa, as well as with church officials in Toronto and elsewhere, and tries to convince his colleagues, who were mostly men at the time, by quoting a woman, a mother, an Indigenous mother, who says, you know, my child might as well be dead if you're taking her away for 8 years at a time. And he shares petitions written by Haida leaders asking for explaining in very cogent, clear language why they would like to have schools closer to home for their children. And they don't understand why the government thinks it's a good idea to rip children away from their land, from their families, from their homes. And so he chastises, he berates his colleagues in the church further east, but they do not listen to him. Interestingly, he did, there had been an industrial school, which is sort of an earlier, different name for a kind of residential school, close to Prince Rupert that was shut down in the early 20th century, and there were no other residential schools built in that area during the time when he was a bishop. I'm not entirely sure that he was the reason for that, but it can't have been just a coincidence that he was such a harsh critic of the schools and that there were none in the area in which he was responsible as a bishop.
So he's living in an area where parents and children are sometimes ripped apart and very far away from each other. And he is also very far away from his own children. This brings us to the bit about Vernet's story that really caught your attention initially, which was Radio Mind itself. Mm-hmm. So what is it? How did you piece together this part of Duvernay's story?
Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, I first came to learn about, or maybe I didn't say this, but I first came to learn about Radio Mind through reading The Canadian Churchman, which was the national Anglican newspaper for much of the 20th century. And I was working on that book on healing, and I was going through The Churchman quite diligently to look for any references to healing. And then here was this really unusual voice, Frédéric Duvernay, writing about all kinds of things. He had things to say about the movies and how they were, the church could learn from what the movies were going to do to young, impressionable brains. And then eventually he starts writing about Radio Mind and his work with telepathy. And he really truly thought of himself as a psychologist, as a scientist, really breaking new ground. He would do these experiments with his daughter, Alice, when he first went to the Diocese of Caledonia. He left his family behind for the first year, about a year, and then they joined him. So he did have his family close by to him once he sort of settled in. They would do these experiments where they would be maybe in different houses, sometimes in different houses, one of them being in Prince Rupert, one of them being in Vancouver, and they would try to communicate by one of them, and they switched back and forth. So it wasn't just that the daughter was the receiver. Sometimes she would be the sender, which was unusual because in a lot of psychic experiments, it's the woman always who's the one who receives, is the passive receiver of the telepathic or psychic transmission. But in this case, they shared those duties. So one of them would relax their mind, prepare themselves to receive the thought, and the other would concentrate on sending it. And by his account, it's literally a sort of muscular relaxation that allows you to sort of receive this spiritual message. So it's a very body-spirit collaboration. And then they had this little piece of paper that would have a sort of fan image with different letters of the alphabet on it. And they would hold a pencil dangling from a string, and wherever it would hit the paper, that was the letter that was being sent from the transmitter, the human transmitter. So it was a very slow process of thought transmission. It was like letter by letter. You wouldn't really be able to get a whole, you know, story in there, but that was enough. And, you know, what was so fascinating was, you know, the Montreal newspapers, the Vancouver newspapers, and the church newspapers all published the results of these scientific experiments. So people were clearly interested in it in some way.
So were there some successes? Did Alice manage to communicate something to her father or vice versa?
She did. And he writes about these successes, and they're written up in newspapers as sort of proof of something, right? So, you know, well, you could imagine that some people, I mean, the Anglican Church in the early 1920, actually the Lambeth Conference, which is the sort of international gathering of all of the Anglicans around the world, the bishops there are warning their parishioners against things like psychic research and theosophy and other kinds of, you know, sort of spiritual sciences. But here this, you know, archbishop is busy doing it in northwestern British Columbia. So it's really quite an interesting juxtaposition.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because it does underline that this is not completely idiosyncratic, in the sense that in certain ways Radio Mind was in sync with other kinds of ideas that were circulating amongst liberal Protestants at the time, or certainly people who were in and out of circles such as theosophy and spiritualism.
For sure, definitely. I don't think he was a theosophist, and I don't think he was a spiritualist. He really did think of himself. I mean, at the same time that he's doing these Radio Mind experiments, he will tell you that it's, you can find it all there in Paul and in, you know, the letters to Paul, the letters of Paul. And he's, you know, he roots himself in these Christian scriptures. But at the same time, one of the most exciting discoveries that I came upon in the course of my research was when I was in that church basement in Prince Rupert in the Anglican archives. My research assistants and I finally sort of looked up at this glass bookcase, and, you know, one of those wooden cases that has these glass doors. And we asked the archivist, "Oh, what's that?" And he said, "Those are Duvernay's books." And sure enough, his wife Stella had donated all of his books, endowed a library in his name in the basement of the church, of the cathedral that he had helped to build. And so we went to the bookshelves and started looking through them. And it was very exciting, because some of his books with lots of marginalia were still there, including books by William James, Henri Bergson, Charles Richer, who was a Nobel Prize winning doctor who himself wrote books about psychic research, and a lot of other really very interesting books were on those shelves, in which he writes in the margin, like, "Oh, this idea of telepathy, I had this idea a year ago when I did my experiments on a Radio Mind." So by reading his marginalia, we get to have a little sense of how he was developing his ideas, not only through these scientific experiments or this sort of spiritual imagination, but through reading what was then the leading psychology of the mind and psychic research. The line between psychology and psychic research was less clearly defined as it is now in the early 20th century. And he was reading all these guys, and he must have been, you know, ordering those books and getting them shipped out to him and reading them. And I should also say that, you know, in the last 4 years of his life, he actually experienced a lot of health problems himself. And so for much of that time, he was bedridden or couldn't be wandering around his diocese. And so spent a lot of that time reading. It's clear from his marginalia.
This is good. It puts into perspective any time that I complain about how slow Amazon.ca is. I should just sort of channel Duvernay and think, you know what? It's not so bad.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people in this book. We've mentioned a number of them, obviously Duvernay, but the Johnstons and McCullough and the Niska printers, Stella and Alice. Who stands out for you as you think about the years that you spent on this project?
That's a good question. Certainly, I wondered a lot about his daughter. I also wondered a lot about a woman, a Tsimshian woman, who featured in his accounts as well. Her name was Odile Morrison. Other people have written about her as well. Her mother was an important midwife in the Tsimshian community. She married a Hudson's Bay Company man, Charles Morrison. And she was an important, a sort of leading figure in his church. So she became an Anglican herself. She also was a correspondent of Franz Boas and the anthropologist, who also loved to record stories from indigenous peoples up and down the coast. So, I mean, anthropologists and missionaries were quite similar in their desire for gathering stories, telling stories, remediating them for different audiences. And of course, anthropologists thought of themselves as much, much better than the missionaries they encountered. But they both had problematic effects on the indigenous peoples whose stories they were sort of extracting. But Odile was interesting because she also published some of her own short reflections on storytelling and on Tsimshian proverbs in the in a folklore journal. I believe it was the Journal of American Folklore. It was interesting for me to think about what. So Frederick Duvernay and his wife Stella had a relationship of friends with Charles Morrison and Odile Morrison, and it was interesting for me to think about how some of the stories that he does tell of indigenous perspectives on the land, on memory, on how to understand a sort of I guess what you might call a Tsimshian creation story of sorts. He does tell some indigenous narratives, and my speculation is that he learned a lot of these narratives through his friendship with Odile Morrison. And so it becomes really interesting to me to think about what it meant for a missionary to be friends with indigenous men and women in the place where he was living. And I think that's a challenging concept for us to think about today, when we're quite aware of the effects that missionaries had on indigenous peoples, on their languages, on their family relations, their territory. But I still think it's worth thinking about what friendship could have been and other ways that it might have developed if Christians and Canadians hadn't been so blind to the importance of what Indigenous stories meant for the land and how the land could be inhabited and shared. I mean, that's what treaties were an attempt by Indigenous peoples to bring together different stories of the land. They're understood as sacred agreements. And Canadians historically and the Crown basically read them as contracts, as Indigenous people giving over their land, which is really not what any Indigenous treaty with the Crown really says. So I do think that stories are really important for the way we understand where we live, how we live on the land, how we treat each other. And it's going back to think about how stories operated in those early days of settler presence on Indigenous land in the Northwest can help us think about what they mean today as well.
On that note, I wanted to ask you about another and really exciting aspect of this research related to that Rainy River trip. So you've been working with communities along the river. What project have you been undertaking with them, working collaboratively with the folks who are still there?
Mm-hmm. When I decided I was going to be working more on Duvernay, and I it might have even been before I decided I was going to write this book, but I had that diary. And as I said earlier, it really spoke to me. It was really a very interesting perspective on both on a missionary and on this land. And I looked up online and saw that the Rainy River First Nations, which is still there on their territory, started something called the Kenachewanung Historical Center, which is a place where they tell their stories to the world. It's on a very amazingly beautiful piece of the shore of the riverbank, where there are ancient burial mounds. I highly recommend any listeners to go and visit it. It's quite a wonderful space. And they care for that land, and they also tell the story of that land in the historical center. So I called up the historical center just sort of out of the blue one day and ended up speaking with a man named Art Hunter, who I'm still working with today on this project, what we now call Story Nations. I brought the diary to Kenachewanung, and Art and his brother Al Hunter were very gracious in welcoming me. And that just started a longer relationship in which I've been bringing students up to Kenachewanung for a number of years now, probably about 6 years. And over the course of those visits, we worked together to build a website to kind of remediate the diary, both with some historical perspectives on it. We sort of re-annotate some of the words he uses are very offensive, calling Ojibwe people heathen, et cetera. And so we try to give context for how he was, for the words that he chose to use in the diary, but also the wider context of Treaty 3 in which he was writing. And we use a lot of images. We're working on a lot of different videos to bring into the website. And we actually, it's still a very much ongoing project, but we launched it just this past June at Kenachewanung on the weekend when they have their powwow. And we were very grateful that Art Hunter was there to help us launch it, and an elder named Willie Wilson, who's been really key in helping us learn stories, the stories of Rainy River First Nations today, and how our project, he's been very gracious in sort of welcoming our project into that community. So yeah, people can go look at that online and see what we tried to do in a website form and what we're still working on today.
And is the URL storynation.com?
It's actually when we were just there, Al and Art helped us to bring an Ojibwe name to it as well. It's called Story Nations Inawin Kawindamowin. So that's an English Anishinaabemowin combination. And the URL is storynations.utoronto.ca.
Now, quoting Clausen to Clausen, stories beget more stories. So what are the stories and questions that you're working on now, either with a different project or extensions of this one?
I'm definitely still working on the website. As I've learned, you can finish a book, but you can never finish a website. So that's just a word of warning. But it is really interesting to continue to think about that project in conjunction with people from Rainy River First Nations. And then I guess the next project I'm thinking about, which is still really just a twinkle in my eye, so to speak, is about gold and gold mining and how the drive for this shiny metal was at once a kind of spiritual desire, a kind of colonial land rush of sorts, and why gold was such powerful metal that it could get people to uproot themselves and travel all around the world, especially in British imperial contexts, and what the sort of cosmologies of land were that could convince one kind of people that it was a great idea to dig up, to disembed from the riverbanks, to build more and more equipment to extract gold from the land, and other cosmologies of land, especially indigenous ones, that thought about that process of extraction quite differently. And what got me there was, you know, that guy, James McCullough, the printer, mm-hmm. turns out that he was also did a little surveying on the side and staked his own claims. I don't think he ever actually managed to find any gold or copper, which was more common in that part of the world. But miners and missionaries often arrived on indigenous lands at the same time and saw each other as competitors, but sometimes they actually worked together. That's what first got me thinking about it. But now I'm sort of thinking about the project in more of a sort of historical way, but also kind of public memory way. Why do we remember gold mining the way we do? Why do parents want to take their children to gold mining heritage parks and actually have them pan for gold? Why have we sort of turned gold mining into entertainment and fable when we know quite well the environmental destruction that that mining of all kinds causes? And how do we tell the stories of mining to ourselves at a time when we know well that it has really high costs for the planet and for the people who live on it?
That sounds wonderful, both historical and also timely. The perfect combination. Well, thank you so much for having come to NVIR to tell us a little bit about Radio Mind. And again, for any listeners, the book is called The Story of Radio Mind, A Missionary's Journey on Indigenous Land, and it's out with the University of Chicago Press. And you should also Google Pamela Clausen, and you can find her website that she's working on collaboratively with the Rainy River Nation.